Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Prison Lawsuits and Private Guards Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On January 10, 2012, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Menachie v. Pollard. The question in this case was whether prison inmates may invoke the Bivens Doctrine to bring suit against the employees of a private company hired by the federal government to provide services for the prison. In an opinion delivered by Justice Breyer, the court held by a vote of 8-1 that it could not imply a Bivens remedy here because state law authorized alternative damages actions that provided both significant deterrence and compensation. Justice Scalia, joined by Justice Thomas, wrote an opinion concurring in the court's judgment. Justice Ginsburg filed a dissenting opinion. To discuss the case, we have Alexander Volokh, who is an assistant professor at Emory University School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Volokh.
Hi, this is Sasha Volokh. I'm from Emory Law School, and I'm going to be talking about a recent case that was just decided by the Supreme Court, Menachie v. Pollard. It was decided on January 10, 2012, and it was an appeal from the Ninth Circuit. Basically, Menachie v. Pollard is one of a long series of cases that's all about clarifying the scope of an early 70s case called Bivens. And Bivens is about damage remedies for federal violations of constitutional rights. Now, cases seeking damages for violation of constitutional rights come in a number of varieties. I think we're all familiar with 1983 actions, basically the Civil War era statute 1983, which says that when state officials violate constitutional rights, then you can sue them and get money. So a lot of prisoner litigation is brought under Section 1983, and that's very familiar and not very controversial in its broad outlines. Now, that's if a prisoner is in a state prison. Now, what if a state prisoner is in a private prison? Well, it's been assumed that private prisons are state actors. Somewhat surprisingly, the Supreme Court has never actually gone out and held that private prisons are state actors, but they've assumed it in several cases, and the courts of appeals have all held this, and they've certainly been right to do so. So we have an assumption that private prisons are state actors, and so if a state prisoner is in a private prison, there's likewise a 1983 action that can be brought, and 1997 case, Richard Sidney v. McKnight, was exactly about that. So if you're a state prisoner, whether you're in a public prison or a private prison, you get the same 1983 protection. Okay, that's fine if you're a state prisoner, but what if you are a federal prisoner? 1983 does not apply. There is a statute giving you damages against state officials, but there is no statute giving you damages against federal officials. And this is quite understandable because of the post-Civil War period when 1983 was passed. But in the 1970s, the Supreme Court decided a case called Bivens, where there was a violation of Fourth Amendment rights by federal agents, and they said that, well, there is no way realistically that this violation of rights can be remedied in this case, and you couldn't sue these officials under state tort law. Among other reasons, state tort law in many cases might be hostile to the interest that you'd be trying to protect. And so therefore, the only way that you could appropriately vindicate the constitutional rights is by having a damages remedy. So in sum, for state prisoners or for state officials, including prison officials, you have a 1983 action. But for federal officials, including federal prison officials, there is a Bivens remedy. And so Bivens was not brought in a prison context, but there was a later case extending Bivens to the Eighth Amendment case in a prisoner context. So now, what about federal prisoners who are held in private prisons? That was a question that had never been resolved by the Supreme Court, and Menachie v. Pollard is about that. And by a vote of 8-1, the Supreme Court held that private federal prisoners could not get a Bivens action. And the reasons that they did so are actually very simple and straightforward if you catch the vibe of recent Bivens cases. In the early days, the Supreme Court was very active in implying private rights of action, and that was the case in the statutory context too. But basically, since about 1980, the Supreme Court has been very hostile to further expansion of the Bivens concept. So, for example, there was a case, Bush v. Lucas. That's where a federal employee was claiming that he was dismissed in violation of the First Amendment. And there, the Supreme Court said, well, there's a congressionally created federal civil service procedure. And so because you have a procedure to vindicate your rights already, you don't need a Bivens action. There was a similar case. There was Chappelle v. Wallace. That was in 1983. And there's some military personnel that said that military supervisors had violated the Constitution in various ways. And there the Supreme Court said, well, actually, there are special factors specific to the military which should make us unwilling to expand Bivens. So already we see two reasons not to expand Bivens, and this is essentially the two-part test that they've been using in Bivens cases. Number one, are there any alternative remedies? And if there are alternative remedies, even if they're not so great, even if they're not as good as the Bivens remedy itself, but if there are other remedies of some sort, then that's a reason not to expand Bivens. But even if there are no remedies, you might still not want to expand Bivens if there are special factors, and that was, for example, in the military context. So there was a case, Schweiker, in 1988, where it was in the Social Security context, and they said, well, I was denied benefits in violation of the Fifth Amendment, and the Supreme Court said no, because there was an administrative scheme already for Social Security, fairly elaborate, even if not ideal from the plaintiff's point of view. So when you put it that way, it actually makes a lot of doctrinal sense why a Bivens remedy was denied in this case. If you have a federal prisoner being held in a public prison, he can't sue the public prison because of the Federal Tort Claims Act. So in the prison context, when there is a private prison, then the private prison is subject to all sorts of state tort law. And this is not the case when you have public prisons. When you have public prisons, the Federal Tort Claims Act applies. But when you have private prisons, the Federal Tort Claims Act does not apply. And so you could just sue these guys on a state law negligence claim. And in fact, in many cases, the state tort claim would be better than a constitutional claim. In Minichie v. Pollard, the specific claim was that the prisoner was being mistreated in terms of his medical care. It was an Eighth Amendment claim based on deliberate indifference to his medical needs. Now, that is a very demanding constitutional standard. You really need to show deliberate indifference. It's not just enough to say, well, I had substandard medical care. On the other hand, in tort law, it is enough to say, I had substandard medical care. Well, you have to show negligence. But showing negligence is a lot easier than showing deliberate indifference. Also, you'd be able to get respondeat superior, which you wouldn't be able to get with Bivens. You'd be able to get punitive damages and so on. So there are all sorts of reasons to think that a state tort law claim might even be better than the Bivens remedy. So from a doctrinal point of view, given the vibe of all of these recent Bivens cases, it seems fairly clear why the Supreme Court denied a remedy here, that there was no particular reason to think that the state tort law remedies would be bad. So, okay, there are a couple of outstanding issues, and one that I wanted to point out is if you're going to be relying on state tort law, that means you're in a to a certain extent subject to the vagaries of tort law. Some states are going to be more generous and some states are going to be less generous, and there might be certain cases that violate the Eighth Amendment which fall through the cracks and that you could not get on a tort law theory. What do you do about those? And the Supreme Court kind of punted on that and said, well, we can look at those cases as they arise. And so it's possible that in some case where you have an Eighth Amendment claim that couldn't be handled by tort law, then you would be able to bring a Bivens action. And what that could mean is that you could have a Bivens action in some states that are less generous and not in other states that are more generous. well, that's interesting. That's a little bit weird. It makes sense on a certain level, but it does introduce a severe non-uniformity and also a lot of uncertainty about whether this Bivens action is going to be available. And there is other language in the opinion that suggests that, no, you're not going to be that case by case about it. It's more about whether the tort remedies in general as a categorical matter are good. That's a kind of interesting outstanding issue that it would be interesting to see more about. That's the main opinion. There's a concurrence with Scalia and Thomas. Scalia and Thomas have always been very hostile to the Bivens remedy entirely. They feel that the invention of this money remedy was an unwarranted intrusion, that it was a kind of judicial activism that they would want to cut down on. Scalia does not advocate overruling Bivens, but he says that there's Bivens in two follow-on cases, and he would restrict them to the exact facts of those cases. And he thinks that in this case, a narrow reading of Bivens does not apply here, but even if the narrowest reading of Bivens did apply, he still would not extend the case that far, because he would limit it to its own facts. So that's a very short, one-paragraph-long opinion, just expressing his continuing hostility to Bivens. The only dissenting justice was Justice Ginsburg. And she basically says, well, look, if Pollard, the prisoner, had been in a federal public facility or a state facility, public or private, he would have a federal remedy for these Eighth Amendment violations. Why should he not have one? Just because he is a federal private prisoner, we ought to have a uniform federal remedy. So that is her dissent, which is for herself alone and is also very short. All I have to say in conclusion is that from a legal perspective, this does seem to have a lot going for it, that making up a damages remedy for constitutional violations, which is what the Supreme Court did in Bivens, it is defensible in various ways, but at the same time, it is an intrusion on the other branches because it does involve money being paid, and so there's similar hesitancy in making the government pay money, which is similar to what lies behind sovereign immunity and other things like that. From a policy perspective, though, if you were just designing a system from scratch, it's hard to justify why you would have a federal remedy for state public prisons, for state private prisons, for federal public prisons, but not for federal private prisons. Especially because private prisons these days have a sort of legitimacy deficit. There's a lot of credible concerns about the treatment of prisoners in private facilities. I'm not saying that necessarily in all cases those concerns are justified, but certainly it would help the cause of prison privatization if prison privatization were accompanied by appropriate accountability guarantees, and federal constitutional remedy could be one of those. So that's all I have to say. It's an interesting case, Minichi v. Pollard, and it'd be interesting to see how some of the outstanding issues continue to play out. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.